Brett, sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Look out, it's only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a joy bundle, and I love film. As Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, always do what you are afraid to do. Like watch Skinamarink on your own in an empty cinema. Go on, big boy, you can do it. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that mean the most to them. Previous guests include Barry Jenkins, Mark Frost, Sharon Stone, and even Yed Blambles. But this week, it's the wonderful comedian, actor, and writer, it's Mr. Ian Sterling. This week, little announcement. Shrinking starts on Apple TV Plus, the show co-created by myself and Bill Lawrence and Jason Segel. Give it a watch. You'll bloody love it. It's on Apple TV Plus from the 27th of January. Go on, have a look. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you'll get an extra 20 minutes of chat with Ian. We laugh a lot. We talk about beginnings and endings. He tells me a secret. You get the whole episode uncut and ad-free. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. So, Ian Sterling is an excellent comedian who became a national treasure as the voice of Love Island. He then went on to co-create, write and star in his own show for ITV, Buffering. Season 2 starts now, has started, is about to start. Look out for it. It's fucking great. I've known Ian for years. We were starting out in stand-up around the same time. He's a lovely, brilliant man and it was a pleasure to catch up with him on Zoom. We recorded this on Zoom a few weeks ago and I really think you're going to love it. He's fucking brilliant, he is. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 232 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is me, Brett Goldstein, and I am joined today by a stand-up, a 99 clubber, a dog ate his homeworker, a CBBC-er, a sitcom writer, actor, showrunner, a creator, a husband, a father,
yes.
And
yes.
And because of his sterling, and I didn't even mean to say it that way, but let's call it what it is, sterling work as the voice of Love Island. He is, of course, a national treasure. Please welcome to the show. He's finally here. It's the one and only. Can you believe it's him? Yes, it is. Here he is. It's Ian Sterling.
Woo, 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 woo.
Hi, Ian Sterling. How are you?
I cheered myself. I don't know how I feel about that.
No, you were right too. It's an impressive list you've got there in the intro.
Thank you for that lovely intro. It's very flattering. And a 99 clubber is,
well,
I think it's the most, I think that's the most niche introduction I've ever had on a podcast.
Well, you and I sort of started similar time, didn't we? And we spent a lot of time doing gigs at the 99 Club, the excellent comedy franchise in London.
There was certainly about a 6 or 7 month period where it was me and you basically gigged together. I would say 4 nights a week.
Yeah. I'd say we were the pillars, the pillars of the 99.
Yeah, like they've done their job, but they weren't hugely entertaining.
They were solid and they held up the ceiling, but they didn't take it off.
you were like, you appreciated that they were there, but there was other stuff going on that was far more interesting.
Yeah. You've had a very varied and excellent career, and you did CBBCs early on in your stand-up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you love that?
Yeah, so I'd done stand-up. I started stand-up first, but then like I'd only been a stand-up for like 5-6 months, and I'd done an open spot at the Comedy Store. So for those that don't know, an open spot's where you do like 5 minutes for no money, and they decide if you should be paid at a later date. In the in terms of the Comedy Store, 15 years and counting. So still open to offers. And then there was a drunk lady there on a night out who said she was a kids' TV producer. And
wanted, you believed her?
No, the opposite. I didn't believe her. I thought she was obviously, I thought it was mad because. I guess you'll know this, like especially when you start doing comedy, you just want a reaction. So you tend to be a lot ruder or like controversial. And also when we started comedy was shock, wasn't it? That was the whole thing. The sort of Frankie Boyle mock the week generation-y sort of thing. So I wasn't very child friendly. So I thought it was a wind up. And then I went home. I didn't stay in London. And then a few days later, the Comedy Store phoned up and went, oh, Children's BBC called asking for your details, because obviously they don't know comedy, so they just assumed that like I played that comedy club full time as my job or something. But fair play to them to get in touch, and then yeah, then the rest is history.
That's
to me
fascinating. What do you think they saw in you if you were doing 5 minutes of filth and pedo jokes that they were like, this guy's a kids TV presenter?
I think I had one bit about going on holiday with my family on a caravan that obviously ended in a pedo joke. Of course it did. Of course it did. But yeah. The start was sort of quite sweet about being young and going on holiday with my family and stuff. And also, I think they'd had a London guy be the presenter before me. So they wanted a not English person, because that was diversity back then. Someone not from London. Honestly, they were literally like, oh, look how progressive we're being.
Yeah.
This guy's went to state school. He can't speak properly. We've absolutely smashed it here. So yeah, I think I got quite lucky on that front. I say that obviously in jest. I'm very grateful to the BBC for those fun years. But yeah, that bit, essentially I was a young person that wasn't from London. And it was at the time when TV producers used to hang around London and give people from London jobs. So they couldn't believe I was there, really.
And then you, because I remember when you first started on Love Island, and like before it was a smash, like right when it started, and you were like, I'm going to have to do this thing. And then suddenly you were selling out the Pleasance Grand. What a life.
Yeah, it was sort of wild, the Love Island thing. And again, it was... I don't know how interesting this is to people, but in the world of like comedy, especially back when we started, it was sort of like, I'll use the word purist, but I think it was sort of more cynical than that. But like the idea of doing something that wasn't stand-up to further your stand-up was sort of frowned upon, right? Do you know what I mean? So like me doing the voiceover on a reality TV show was sort of seen as this huge gamble, which seems mad now, even in the sense that like I was basically getting paid money, which at the time I didn't have any money at all, and they were going to pay me money to like be on the telly, and I was like, oh, but I need to do the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and stuff, and like comics, and I was thinking the same. A lot of them were like, oh, I wouldn't bother doing that because you'll not get booked for, you know, Radio 4 or Latitude or whatever if you do that. And now you've got obviously people that sort of no one gets big in stand-up through stand-up these days.
No, stand-up's the worst way to get big in stand-up.
If you want to get big in stand-up, stay away from stand-up. That's the worst thing.
If you're trying to get big in stand-up by doing stand-up.
If you're doing stand-up instead of recording a podcast, what the fuck are you thinking? how are you going to sell any tickets to anything?
If you think diligently applying your craft year after year is a way to get people to come and see your craft, you're insane.
Get in the jungle. Come on, let's make this happen.
And then now you're a bloody showrunner. You're a co-creator, writer, actor, star of your own sitcom.
Yeah.
Tell me how that experience was for you. particularly you've got a second season coming out. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, man.
The first season, and how much were you like, this is incredible, and how much were you like, this is so stressful and overwhelming, I have no idea what's going on.
So we filmed the first two episodes pre-COVID and then filming stopped in the middle. And the first two episodes were blessed because me and my friend Steve Bajer, who wrote it together, sort of, and this is a bad thing, but we were, we wrote the first two episodes. It got commissioned very quick. I think I had a sort of, because I'd done, it's about kids TV and I had loads of stand about kids TV. So there's lots of sort of solid, in terms of like when you pitch a thing, I had quite a lot of like funny stories and Love Island was sort of popular and stuff. So we just got given this thing and they were like, make it. And we at the time, I didn't know how quickly they wanted us to make it. We had like a few months and we didn't have like any like producers or script editors or anything. And neither of us had written a thing. So we sort of, the first two episodes were this like 45 minute pilot, essentially. But because we'd never done it, we didn't realize, obviously we were like, so rather than stress, we were just like, wow, all these people are here because we wrote a thing. And then COVID happened and we had like a year and a half to like look at those episodes again. And we got like really talented like script editors and producers and all that. And that's when the stress happened of like, oh, we've not said anyone's name or like the audience don't know why any of this is happening. And so then from then on in, it was, a lot, the stress came in and all that. So the great thing about the second series is I feel like we learned so much on the first and now it is a sort of really collaborative. And obviously I wasn't like show running or involved particularly in the show in the first series because I didn't know what a mark was. I didn't know where to like stand when you're acting. And I'd never like been involved in like an edit or directing or anything. I've done a bit of that since. So yeah, second series is a lot more collaborative. I'm involved in it loads. And like, I'm just so like, I'm in that stage where we've just finished, sort of signed it all off. And it's not on and it's a few weeks away from being on the telly at time of recording. So
this is the scary bit.
Well, I'm in the blissful, we've made a thing, I think it's amazing bit. And then I'm about to hit the stage where you show it to your nearest and dearest and they don't sort of like die laughing and cry at the emotional bits. Then you go, oh God, it's not the best thing ever. And you start panicking and then a week before it comes out and that is just horrendous, like horrible.
What's the deal, if I may ask? I'm always interested in creative partnerships. You and Steve, very funny Steve, who wrote and co-created it together. Do you have a deal of like 50-50, say? Like you both have to agree on a thing or how does it work?
Absolutely. I've actually started applying my relationship with Steve to my marriage in terms of I feel like we've been so clear on how we're doing it to not cause any ruptions. So it's everything's 50-50 down to the tiniest detail. And the other thing we've got, if any of us hear any news or developments or have any thoughts, we've got a rule where you've got to sort of immediately text or phone the person and tell them what's happening. So, you know, like from like, oh, I think Bloody Blah's hair should be pink, all the way to like the boring stuff like, oh, FYI, my agent's just called and I'm going to be get a car in today rather than getting the train. Like just everything, we just completely tell everyone everything. And that open communication has actually been phenomenal in all of my relationships. But again, we both work in show business. You know that double acts have been broken up and worse things than someone showing up in a car while the other person's like got the train to work. So yeah, that we try and completely split like everything really.
That's great.
Because we work quite well in terms of like, we always say we used to write stand-up that together. That's how we got into the world of like writing a sitcom. And we always say with the reason we work quite well together when we do stand-up is we look at it like in Steve's stand-up, you know what he's selling, but you don't know if you want it. And with mine, my stand-up, you want it, but you don't know what it is. And I think that, but I'm more a vibey person and he's sort of he does a thing where he like writes jokes and stuff, which I'm not, I can't be bothered with all that. I just go for a funny concept and just see what happens.
That's a perfect partnership.
Yeah, it's nice.
So you're selling something that people want as a group.
Yeah, I mean, if I'd got onto the crypto scene early doors, I'd have cleaned up, I think, basically. Something of absolutely no value that you can trick people into thinking is incredibly important in their lives. That's my vibe. Right. Steve's a more a stocks and shares guy. I think you're a stocks and I've seen a few of your shows and I think you're very stocks and you're in a good way stocks and shares. You know what you're doing.
Well, as in, here's what I'm presenting, but you might not want it.
No, but I want it, man. The wanting it bit's the bit that comes, the bit it comes, doesn't it? It always comes eventually.
What's nice, you know those videos that people make where it's like, I took a picture every day and their face changes. Yeah. So I actually haven't seen you in person in probably 4 years, 3 years.
Yeah.
And in that time, I've seen you a lot on this screen that I'm looking at you now on.
In this exact position, exact configuration.
And during that time, we sometimes played poker during lockdown and stuff. And during that time, I've seen you become go from man playing poker in a lockdown to a husband, to a showrunner, to a father. And it's just every time I see you, it's like more and more. It's great. It's fucking beautiful, man.
Well, you went from writing a show none of us had heard of to swearing at the Emmys. So I bet we've all been on a journey.
And quickly, we don't have to dwell on your private business, but
let's dwell.
Has being a dad been a thing? Is it a thing?
I tell you what.
Yeah.
It's a thing. I did not know how much of a thing it was, actually. You guys, really is. Honestly, it doesn't want to let up, the whole being a dad thing. I love it. I don't know. It's so tricky talking about being a dad in the sense of like, I really like fucking love, like I really love it. Like, and then also like, I always thought I'd be good at it.
Right.
And in my life, I've always thought I was going to be terrible at everything. I think it's because I went to this sort of school where people were like, you were like, don't have ambition, it's for idiots sort of thing. And teachers would be, I remember once in my school, my friend Peter said he wanted to be a footballer. And the teacher said, why don't you be a postman like your dad? And it was just like that sort of like vibe. But I've always sort of had it in my head that I'd be good at being a dad. And I don't know, I think I've sort of quite good at it, and I'm useless at everything else, so it's a really nice feeling. But then also at the same time, it's like, as a comic, you're sort of designed to be like, oh, I never sleep and it's awful, but like it's really great. I mean, I do sticker books at 6 a.m. it's class. I hope that comes across. So people that haven't got kids, it's like a thing of like, I'm doing something I like. And if you've got a kid or kids on its way, like, I think it's sometimes nice to hear someone be like, oh, it's really great. Because as a dad, basically everyone just goes, oh, how old's your kid? And you say the age and they go, well, wait till this stage, it will get worse.
Yeah.
That's all anyone ever does. Wait till they walk, then it'll be rubbish. Wait till they can answer back. And you're like, yeah. So I quite like being like, no, it gets better every time. It's really fun.
It's dead. Well, it seems a shame that I forgot to tell you something that I'm now going to tell you. It seems a real shame, actually. God, I feel bad about it.
I forgot about this bit as well. After I've just talked about my heavily dependent, I think we've assessed, I very much need to be with it.
Yeah, and yet, oh man, you've died.
Oh, I should. I don't know why. Awful. I agreed to do this.
Awful. How did you die, man? What a shame.
Do you know how I died?
No, do you?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Choked on a sticker.
You were helping your baby with the sticker book. I'm assuming the baby was there.
Well, yeah, to make me feel less guilty, I've made it that it's their fault.
Okay. So baby hands you a sticker and says, eat this.
It's a fruit. Let's go with a fruit sticker. It's a tangerine sticker.
Okay.
We're role playing, and to get into the part, I pop it in. It's because of this sort of like sticky nature of a sticker.
Yeah.
That's what a sentence that is by a professional talker. it sticks to my gullet. Jeez. I'm choking.
Yeah.
That's upsetting for the child. So to make them feel less upset, I eat more. They're finding that funny, the stick. So I eat more stickers to sort of lighten the mood. And then that it sort of congeals into a sort of plug.
This is a heroic and dreadful death. I mean, for the baby, at first is disturbed, then thinks, oh no, daddy's being funny, and then daddy dies in front of baby. I mean, it's a...
But they wouldn't know. They would not know. I style it out unbelievably.
Right. How?
No trauma, absolutely nothing. They think it's hilarious.
Okay.
We're all good.
Okay. Well, that's a lovely story. All right, do you worry about death? Do you worry about death?
I think it's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? But yeah, every year it becomes more. Every year you get older and, oh my gosh, this is... I went from the positive about my child to like, every year you get older and the people nearest and dearest to you get older, you worry more about the inevitable demise. I'd like to think I'm in the middle ground, because then I guess I would like to think you get to an age where you don't, you're not okay with it, but you then come to terms with it. You are comfortable with it. There must be an age where that kicks in.
I don't know. I don't know if it was on this podcast someone said it to me or I read it or something, but it's, I mean, if I tell you this, it might haunt you, but it was the idea that let's say you live till 80, right? So you get to 40 and you go, oh, well, I've still got the same
half
amount of
it,
time
yeah.
left. But then the reality is time moves faster the older you get. When you were like 1 to 10, time took forever because there was only 1 to 10. But every year, your life gets quicker. So although you might have 40 years left, those 40 years are probably really the equivalent of 20. So, you know what I mean? So actually...
Yeah, and also you know that there's less years where you're going to be... And I don't even mean at the very end. I just mean like there's going to be years where you're like ill or... got a bad back.
Oh, Christ.
So, oh my God.
God, why did you bring this up? Do you think there's an afterlife?
No, sadly, no. I think there is. I think you live on through those people like nearest to you and like there's little ripples.
Oh, listen, your kid is going to be talking about that death for the rest of his life. You will definitely live on in therapy sessions.
I'm going to live on by paying off therapist tax bills. In
stand-up shows. Probably do a stand-up show about it.
Oh, Mark. If that's how your dad dies, you are going to win the Perrier. Like, that is phenomenal.
Yeah, you're winning the award. You know you've done some serious damage.
My dad went out like Tommy Cooper at 6 a.m. on a Paw Patrol sticker book. What a legend.
And the show is called Tangerine. That's the name of the stand-up show.
Oh, yes.
That,
and one name stand-up shows are so trendy AF.
And it's your kid quite low in the poster, quite low, holding a little tangerine. And the rest of it's a lot of negative space and just tangerine.
I was thinking a lot of negative space, nose upwards, bottom of the page. Like, did you ever draw those pictures of like someone looking over the wall?
Yeah.
That, and they've just got a tangerine on their head. Yeah.
Fucking hell. Anyway, listen, buddy boy, good news for you. There is an afterlife. There's a place. You'll love it there. It's filled with your favorite thing. What's your favorite thing?
Pasta.
It is made of pasta. This place. And it's the right, you like it, you want to sit on a pasta seat. It's a little al dente, perhaps.
I was going to give you the word, but I knew you had it in you. I believed in you.
Everything, you're being served pasta by pasta people. You know those like macaroni men you see in the adverts, they're walking
pasta
around.
Pasta people, chefs. There's chefs there.
They're chefs, but they're made of pasta.
Or, oh, that makes more sense. I thought you'd been in Hollywood too long and you'd like...
You know,
had
the pasta people.
Get me a car, people. Get me a car, people, to take me out.
The cupcake guy. anyway.
And where's the letter guy? Where's the letter guy?
And they're very excited to see you. And they want to talk to you about your life. But they want to talk about it through the medium of film.
Oh, wow.
The first thing, and it's weird, and the first thing they say is, what's the first film you remember seeing, Ian Sterling?
It was in the cinema, and it was Snow White.
Holy shit. I'm assuming it re-released, unless you're much younger than you look.
No, I think it must have been. I don't really remember the time, because I'm trying to, like, I was born in 1988. So I think Snow White came out before then. But it was definitely in the cinema, and I don't really remember what sort of Disney films were actually released around the time I was born, but like it was a full cinema. It wasn't like, you know, I'm from the streets, mate. I wasn't in some bloody gaff in Hoxton. Like where someone's gone from yoga. Yeah, some picture house, you go from your Pilates class to watch a re-released Disney number.
How old were you?
I can't actually remember, but I was walking, I was talking. Okay. My sister was there, who's 2 years younger than me. So I'm thinking I'm going to ballpark it at 5 or 6. Okay. And I think the reason I remember it is because obviously it was the first trip to the cinema, the popcorn, the cool.
Fantastic.
This is genuinely my first memories is the seat that pulling the seat down to sit on it blew I thought it was the cleverest thing that had ever happened.
Yeah.
And I remember just standing up and sitting down all the time throughout the whole film going, and I remember thinking, how does it know? How does the seat know I've stood up?
It was sentient.
Yeah. I probably thought it was.
Wow.
So Snow White.
Did it scare you?
It did, yeah. The lady, when she's the old witch lady at the very beginning. I was nearly out the door. My mum really had to work to keep me in the cinema. And then obviously the seven dwarfs show up. I forgot the second part of the title of that film there for a second. And I had a real al dente moment, actually. the seven dwarfs and all that, that was bliss. And then it gets sort of scary again towards the end. But yeah, no, I was scared at the queen turns herself into an old lady for the whole apple scenario.
Yeah.
That scared me.
That's a great first film. What about being scared? What's the film that scared you the most?
I'm a huge horror fan. There was a...
Is your wife? Or is it something separately?
No, literally. Well, I don't really watch it at all now, really. Occasionally. Okay. But that was like all I... When as a single man in my early stand-up days, all I watched was stand-up DVDs and terrible horror films. And then... On Kids TV, I used to present with Hacker the Dog, and we lived together, and he loved really bad horror films as well. So we just used to watch like so many awful, awful horror films, like budget independent stuff, everything.
Did I know you and Hacker the Dog lived together?
We lived together. Yeah. We lived together, and he used to, all the hob was all multicolored because he used to dye fleece when he built puppets and then he'd never clean up after himself, so we had a sort of multicolored hob. Phil Fletcher, you should get him on Instagram. He makes all these puppets from scratch and he's a phenomenal talent, actually. Yeah, so I love horror films, but the film that scared me the most when I was a kid is quite a bad horror film. It's Blair Witch Project 2.
Oh, Book of Shadows?
I think so, yeah. I just remember being a big... I just remember me and my friend Mark used to watch horror films as a kid, and then we'd like scare each other. Like, do you remember one would go to the toilet, we'd hide and like, whoa, all that sort of stuff. But for some reason, halfway through the Blair Witch Project 2, Book of Shadows, we just looked at each other and we're like, not tonight. Not tonight, it's too much. I remember them all being locked in some sort of like office or warehouse or something near the end, and we were like, this is insane. We're like, why would anyone? Know that thing where you thought, how did the people think this up?
Oh yeah,
I was watching because I was watching Fresh recently with my wife and mother-in-law.
Right.
Do you know that film where they sell
with
the body?
With Daisy Edgar
Jones, and my mother-in-law was just sort of going, the people that thought this up are sick. Like, angry at them.
I mean, there's some truth in it. I think of all fiction. I mean, I think it's sicker to come up with Manchester by the Sea. Like,
100%.
I go, you sat around dreaming up what would happen if all your kids died in a fire.
In a fire. And then you were really stoic about it until you got questioned by the police near the end. They're either mad or they want an Oscar. It's one of the two. And it's not for us to decide what's happened with that.
Maureen, what's this I hear about you going to film school? I am. I want to gain valuable skills while making films and developing my creativity. So I'm attending the New York Film Academy. I'm thinking about becoming one of them people that writes the numbers on the title board. NYFA is a very respected film school. I hear they offer a variety of options to meet your educational goals, whether you want a BFA or MFA degree, or want to learn at a quicker pace with a short-term programme. That's right! They've got workshops and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, cinematography, screenwriting, producing, game design, musical theatre, and more. Are you attending in New York? Might do. They have multiple campuses in some amazing locations like New York, LA, Miami, Italy, Australia, and online. And you can learn more about the New York Film Academy at nyfa.edu. That's nyfa.edu. Thanks, Maureen.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
What about crying? Are you a crier? What's the film that made you cry the most?
Mate, the most exciting thing about this question is it happened 3 days ago.
Oh, wow.
Literally 3 days ago. A Man Called Otto.
No.
Buddy, full disclosure... Yeah. I was up in Scotland, obviously, because we've not really got grandparents so around in London. So my mum and dad took the little one. So we went out for a meal and we were literally walking past the Odeon on the way home. We went, we're just going to go and see whatever's on. It was A Man Called Otto. To be full disclosure, I was sort of a bit gutted, really. I thought, oh, God, yeah. A 2-hour Tom Hanks film where nothing happens. Fuck's sake. It's beautiful, man. It's so amazing. And it's just so lovely and like heartwarming. But then there's all the cliched sad stuff at the end happens. And there's a scene, I don't want to do like spoilers because it's like in the cinema, but there's a scene where he basically gives this couple like a thing that was like really important to him growing up. He plays a very stoic, lonely man. And he sort of befriends this family and becomes ingratiated with the family. It's gorgeous. Performances are amazing. It's filmed brilliantly. And I've never had, but not in like the last 15 years, a physical reaction where like I just like threw myself back. There was also four of us in the cinema, me and my wife included. So I could really let go. And I was... I'd had a bottle of red wine and a lovely meal, so I was in a lovely headspace, and I knew I wasn't getting up for a child the next day, so I was like, hey, let's rip. But yeah, that is the most I've cried at a thing, and I couldn't tell you how long.
Wow. Did your wife cry, or was she looking at you like you're mad? Oh, you both did.
Oh yeah, I think if you can, that film is like that film is made to, like, Ricky Gervais would watch that and be like, fair play. You've put the music in the right place. You've touched on all the right topics. That is brilliant. And I think it comes across, I don't mean that as a criticism, but it's like phenomenally well done on either side. It's brilliant. It's so brilliant.
Oh, interesting.
You have to see it. The good thing about it is it's great seeing things in the cinema, obviously, but you have to see it in the cinema film.
Right.
You have to watch it on your own, I think. Oh my God, it's so sad.
Yeah, if it's going to make me cry, I'm definitely seeing it on my own.
Good man. Good man.
What about a film? What's the film that you love? Most people don't like it. It's not critically acclaimed, but you think it's fucking brilliant.
Well, I mean, there's about 7 to choose from here. Mm-hmm. Because for me, it's the Wrong Turn franchise.
Oh, wow. I don't think that's come up in... Maybe it came up once, but definitely not the franchise as a whole.
Oh, it's phenomenal.
That's a lot of wrong turns. Seven wrong turns will send you straight back to where you started, I'd have thought.
Not in this film. There's just people take a wrong turn, they get killed, then there's the credits, then a film starts. It's brilliant. It's so bad and so brilliant. And they always seem to get the right side of, like, it's like a horror film. I reckon you could watch it on your own and be afraid, but you can watch it. What's amazing, you watch Wrong Turn films as a collective. Mm-hmm. You'll get the person that hates horror film who'll be absolutely shitting themselves.
Right.
People that like cinema who will be furious that it's happening. And then people that are like, can see the funny side of it, find it so funny. It just touches every topic. Like, there's always an attractive couple at the start having sex in the open for no reason whatsoever. They get killed horrifically by some deformed person. And then another film begins every time. It's so great. They're so great. I think Wrong Turn 2 is probably the best.
Right.
Or Wrong Turn. 6 is good as well, though.
But 3, 4, 5, you'd avoid.
Yeah, there's one where there's one that's not aged brilliantly because it's set in the sort of world of social media. Okay. And it's like funny watching what people in 2008 thought social media was going to be like. It sort of dates it a lot.
Okay.
But they're all good. I mean, none of them are critically, they're not like, not like certain horror films.
I don't think any of them are critically acclaimed. Do you know what my horror franchise of choice that I love?
I'd love to have a bang. Hills of Eyes?
No. The Paranormal Activity franchise.
Oh my God. But then, see the thing about Paranormal Activity, what it has that Wrong Turn doesn't is, Paranormal Activity 1 is great. It's actually good cinema, technically speaking.
Great. They're both great.
But then they went cash in later, like Saw, like Paranormal Activity, whereas Wrong Turn was shit.
Yeah, to start with.
And it's just got shitter. Basically, Wrong Turn was shit, and then they just made it cheaper for 9 times.
Impressive. Great answer. What is a film that you used to love, but you've seen it recently and you do not like it anymore for whatever
this
reason?
This is the one. I don't listen to this. I've listened to quite a few of these podcasts. I think this is a bit of a cliche answer, but it's American Pie.
Okay. I understand.
As a teenage boy, I thought it was so hilarious and sexy. And then obviously now you watch it, you go, oh, that's why a lot of men are a problem. Literally, you watch American Pie and you can explain a whole generation of creeps.
Oh my God. It's all American Pie's fault.
In American Pie, they hide a webcam in a girl's room, and it's like, see, there's this like really great thing that's about to happen.
I have talked about this before. Not only is it wild, but it's wild that it wasn't wild at the time.
It's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
It's absolutely insane. There's like, I couldn't believe it when I sort of like watched it again and years ago. And then it made me think about that whole generation. And then there's like, then you think of like all, know that whole like the bands of that generation that came just after that, indie, all the lyrics in those songs are fucking mental. Like insane. Because like the other day, Pigeon Detectives, this is really off topic, but like Pigeon Detectives came up. Their first single was called Take Her Back. And it's about her being possibly too. Mad, God. And like it's insane. And yeah, when you watch, and it's so annoying because American Pie, like the music's so great, the performances are so great, and then every second concept in it is fucking horrific.
It is a shame because there's also a real sweetness in that film, and it's got quite a nice
The main character's relationship with his dad's so beautiful. Like, yeah, there's so much nice stuff in it.
There's a lot to love other than the, you know, revenge porn and fucking darkness in it. But other than that, it's a lovely, cheeky film.
the guy that taught a generation of boys that to giving a semen donation meant you got a fit girl stuck a finger up your arse for What? and then that was him for the rest of his life. That's all that could happen.
Yeah.
Oh my God. You sort of can't even talk about it in terms of like, how mad is this in a funny way? It's like, no, that's it's
just collectively mental as well. That at the time, as far as I remember, I was very young. Perhaps there were many people writing, "This is outrageous."
I didn't hear anything.
There was no
oh, the woke brigade are after American Pie again.
Yeah,
they're just like American. What a legend!
What is the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film itself is good, but the experience you had around seeing the film will always make it special to you, Ian Sterling.
Well, I'm double lucky because it's a great film as well. Right. I like a lot of terrible films, but and I mean that obviously fondly.
Yes.
But Good Will Hunting, man.
Good film?
Yeah, it's just basically when I moved out of my flat, we moved up my parents to go to university. I live with my mate Scott. We both done law, but like Scott's amazing. But I was into like football and nightclubs, and he would stay at home on a Saturday and learn John F. Kennedy and Winston Churchill speeches, and had like leather bound books everywhere. And we were in this flat and we were like really close and we didn't have a thing. And then basically Robin Williams became our thing. And I'd never seen Good Will Hunting, and he showed me it. I don't think I'd ever watched good stuff. Like, right. I listened to like hardcore house dance music when I was a kid, and then got into like pop punk at university and like went to football and like watched like American Pie and like Footballers' Wives and Stan Holly. And then he showed me like proper cinema. Yeah. When cinema done well gets you, and I'm 19 and I've never been exposed to that sort of thing in my life, and it was funny. I thought it'd be dead boring because obviously at school you go to like a play or whatever, but this was like, it blew my mind. And like, it's got about 19 iconic scenes in it.
Yeah, it's true. It is true. It's really held up. And perhaps he showed it to you because he was like, "I'm Will Hunting. You don't understand me, but I'm here."
Oh, I mean, if you watch Will Hunting as a man under the age of 25, you're watching it the whole time going, I am Will Hunting.
You weren't thinking I'm Ben Affleck.
Oh, I mean, I was Ben Affleck, but Ben Affleck's doesn't think he's Ben Affleck. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Jock
doesn't know he's a jock.
Right.
I'm there wearing the same training top Ben Affleck's got on, going, drinking a lager.
I'm probably good at maths.
I'm terrible at maths, going, "I'm definitely Will Hunting."
What is the film you most relate to, Ian Sterling?
Well, annoyingly, it is probably Good Will Hunting. But I don't know if you can give me a hot take on it. Well, I think the reason, basically, I felt like I was Good Will Hunting in the sense that I went to my school. I was the only boy from my year to go to university, and I don't mean that in terms of I don't mean that in a clever Good Will Hunting thing. Oh. But what I mean was, I basically was taught like in my school I basically went to university and I met people that wanted to like be like actors and politicians and, you mean, all this stuff. And I'd never been exposed to that world before, and it sort of like blew my mind. And I felt like that's what like Will Hunting was when he was exposed to like therapy and maths. And I thought like, oh, he's going on this mad journey. And I really felt like at university I'd met these people who like went out drinking but also studied. Do you know what I mean? And like dated girls, but and didn't get in fights with bounce. I was just sort of like, there's a place that I sit in the world, which is what I felt like Will finds in that film. Because although he's fighting against the whole world of like working, being a genius and having prospects and all that. He's fighting against it. I think he does want to, it takes his friends telling him you can be both. That's, yeah. I think that's what that film is for Will in it, is him realizing that you don't have to be one thing. You can be the guy from Southie and you can be a genius. I don't think he knew that was an option. Because in the world we live in, you're never told that's an option, really. You're always told you're this thing or you're that thing. And that's basically what university was to me. I realized, oh yeah, I can study and work hard, and I can be a pisshead. This is ideal. I can fight bouncers and then write them a legal letter explaining to them why they're wrong.
That's very, I really like that. I like that a lot. What is objectively the greatest film of all time, Ian Sterling? Objectively, it might not be your favourite, but it's the greatest.
It's a good question. And again, I'm not gonna, but we could easily put Good Will Hunting could fall into there. Right again. I'm going to say I, Daniel Blake.
Wow.
I mean, full disclosure, I saw it in the cinema.
Yeah.
In Newcastle.
Right.
The week it came out. And I've never been in a theatre where it was only a little 60-seater and nobody left that theatre for like 5 minutes after the end. I do think it's got really, the performances in it are like
incredible,
really on point, phenomenal.
Yeah.
It deals with, like, I think really interesting social issues, which actually at the time I don't think were being massively portrayed on screen. I think the sort of like, particularly a working class man struggle was certainly not being shown. And I just think it's sort of like, sometimes filmmaking, I think this, the way it's cut, edited, written, I think there's the thing when I always say, like, sometimes, like, as a film, like, it's that whole, like, idea of, like, when, this sounds mad, but like, if you, like, fry an egg, it's, like, really simple. But if you fuck it up, it's horrendous. And, like, they've just, like, there's all the basic parts in there, because it's a really, like, stripped down production, and they've just got them all right. So to watch it, I think, oh, that's bang on. I really liked it. And again, that's actually probably the most I've cried since I watched
A Man Called Otto.
A Man Called Otto.
You know what? I'm going to let you have it. I, Daniel Blake, the greatest film of all time. What's the sexiest film you've ever seen? Is it also Good Will Hunting?
It's Good Will Hunting. No, it's Bend It Like Beckham.
Oh, yeah. Go on. Sexy football film.
Yeah, well, I was a 13-year-old boy that was obsessed with football.
Yeah.
And then Keira Knightley came on telly, on the screen, she's probably like 3 years older than me. So in my head, I was like, there's a movie star that's my age that would date me in real life. And she's like good at football. And she's like, wears sexy, cool clothes on a night out and like just chills out in her sports bra looking wicked. And as a young man, I couldn't, because again, sign of the generation, even a girl playing football was like, what? Yeah. And it being cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keira Knightley and Bend It Like Beckham, man.
Great shout.
Obviously, as a 35-year-old man, what a horrible thing to say.
Speaking of which, Travelling Bonus, Worrying Why Dons, a film you found arousing, you weren't sure you should.
Oh, it's basic, but Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Bob Hoskins?
Yes, Bob Hoskins, what a ride. Jessica Rabbit.
Is that a problem? She's so fit.
She's a cartoon. She's not got a third D. she's got 2D. No, she's got, she's 2D.
She's got enough Ds.
She's a 2D with a lot of D. Yeah, is that, do you think that's not problematic?
I'm just like, If you're not meant to get a boner, then I don't understand anything.
I mean, well,
then nothing makes sense.
Well, if you want to be even more honest, Planet of the Apes.
Now you're talking. Which one? The original?
You're joking. They're boofing in the original. Absolute munters in the original. The remake. But the first one. Not the original Planet of the Apes remake.
The None Tim Burton one with Mark, yes. Marky Mark.
Yeah.
So you like sexy, you like Helen Bonham Carter monkey.
Helen Bonham Carter monkey is the Keira Knightley of my 20s.
That is an answer I can respect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. What is the film you could or have watched the most over and over again?
Oh, another easy one for me, Aladdin, the original.
Great film.
Just, again, a bit of a... I've tried to cut the Robin Williams references down because he appears in the four times I reference Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
But I think it's the best voiceover performance of all time. It's just flawless. It's amazing. I've not done enough research to back this up, but it would be in the debate for the performance that lifts a film into, do you know when like that one person just brings a film into that next echelon? Robin Williams is a genie, just takes that film from like great to like a platinum classic.
And it's I was thinking about it recently, like it really suits his improv, that film. Like they animate all his voices, you know, like in the parade and doing it. Like it's a really good match of like animators and his stuff.
There's loads of stuff online if everyone's that way inclined with like the original script plus what he did, stuff like that. It's so great. He basically wrote the character in a booth on his own.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
Fantastic. We don't like to be negative, Ian Stanley. What's the worst film you've ever seen?
Oh, well, again, I have not been to cinema in ages due to recently having a child, but I've been twice this week and I saw The Thing I Cried the Most At and the worst film of all time. Which and it's was? Called Babylon.
How
it's
dare you.
Fucking horrendous. It is 3 hours and 10 minutes long, so it can already fuck off.
It is long.
What's annoying about it is it's got about three or four scenes that are unbelievable.
Yeah.
Margot Robbie is unbelievable in every sense of the word. Brad Pitt is Brad Pitt in every sense of the world. It just goes on for fucking ages and it's so up its own arse, and I can just picture everyone involved in that film watching it back again and again and again going, aren't we clever? And there's like a joke in it. There's a joke in it where like they go like, oh God, there's like some reference to like mental people. They go, it's a lot like hanging out in Hollywood. And you're like, oh, go away. And then at the end, the main character, I'm not going to ruin it for you because you might still want to see it. The main character's like crying and this like they've almost got like a contra zoom close up happening, and they start showing like all other cinema from history and like, oh, how important making film is, and our film's the film that's going to tell the story of how important film is. And by this point the film's ended 19 times and I'm just like, oh, what a waste of amazing, like, there's so many elements of it that are brilliant. And then they've just tried to be really clever for no reason. And it's just, oh God, I hated it.
Well, for the record,
I bet you liked it.
I did like it. But I did know an awful lot of people that really hated it. And I definitely went in with low expectations because everyone hated it. And I went on a Sunday morning and I watched it and I was like,
and you left
really
on you left on Tuesday afternoon.
On Tuesday, yeah. On a high. I think I really liked it, but I get it. I get what you're saying, and you're not alone in feeling that.
Yeah, I really
really liked it. You're in comedy, you're a very funny comedian. What's the film that made you laugh the most, you crazy
Good
guy?
Will Hunt, no. probably Anchorman.
Funny film. It's a funny film.
Yeah, probably Anchorman made me laugh the most. As in like, I'm talking like absolutely like laugh out loud. Again, could be like a bit to do with timing. I was like prime chilling out in my flat share watching a thing with the guys where we could like quote it back at one another and all that. But just really funny. That same sort of Aladdin, I guess, genie improv-y sort of vibe, which I quite like. Like I've said that before, like I like the sort of the vibe of a joke rather than like the craftsmanship of it, I appreciate. So it's probably a lot of that involved. I think, yeah, they're all really good in it, which is obviously helpful. Costumes are funny. I don't think there's not a moment of that film that they're not trying to be funny, which is good. Everything about it, the names of the characters, the way they're dressed, even the way they, the sort of like weirdly 80s, 90s, like sort of like vignettes and stuff they use to like cut between scenes are sort of funny. It's funny. It's just funny. It is just funny.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, you're not wrong. It's funny. Ian Sterling, you've been a joy. However, when you were doing a sticker album with your baby at 6 in the morning and the baby handed you tangerine sticker and you said, you being a natural clown, pretended to eat the tangerine got lodged in your gullet, your word, and suddenly you were choking and the baby looked distressed and you were like trying to say, no, everything's fine, but you couldn't. So you grabbed a load of tangerine stickers and threw them on top of the other tangerine sticker.
Yeah.
Thus creating a mulchy cork in your throat.
Oh, I like that word.
And you were dying. I mean, you couldn't breathe. No one else, your wife was out. And the baby's laughing and laughing. And you're going, well, leave them wanting more. And
you
did a spin and you fell onto your back, baby crying, laughing. And luckily your wife comes home sooner, moves the baby out, goes, Ian's being silly on the floor, picks up baby, they go out. I'm walking past with a coffee, and you know what I'm like.
Love, and I go,
oh, I'll check in on Ian. I haven't seen him in person in a while. Go in, there you are, dead on the floor. And because of all the tangerine stickers you've eaten, you're absolutely bloated. Your whole body's like a fucking balloon. So I grab some knives, start chopping you up. Stuff goes everywhere. Chopping you up into little pieces. Baby comes back in. I'm like, oh, this isn't good. But I am, I sort of say to baby, listen, put this in the 45-minute mark of your stand-up show.
You don't know about lulls yet, but it's coming.
You will. And both in
comedy and life.
Okay, help me out here. We stuff your body in the coffin. There's more of you than I was expecting. The coffin's absolutely rammed. There's only enough room in this coffin for me to slip one DVD into the side for you to take across. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. What film are you taking to show the pasta people and the cupcake kids in the afterlife when it is your turn?
Do you know what? I thought it was going to be Good Will Hunting, but Jen, I'm not just going to say the same thing. Because I talked to you about it and I feel really happy about it, I think I just want pure unadulterated joy in the afterlife. Yeah. So I'm going to go with I'm going to pop Aladdin in there. I'm not going to pop Aladdin. I'm going to pop the film Aladdin in.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love it. Ian Sterling, before we go, I'd like to plug your child's upcoming stand-up show Tangerine. Poster this. For those watching on the Zoom, the poster is this with the tangerine on the head. I'm really excited then. They're going to win everything.
They're going to win the Perry, and then it'll do a West End run, but in like a sort of cool, smaller theatre, nothing too showy.
I love it. Now, you need to tell us what to look out for. I believe Buffering Season 2 is on its way. I don't know when this episode's coming out, but tell me the dates.
January the 30th, Buffering Series 2 drops on ITV2, and then all episodes will be available on ITVX.
That is fucking cool. Is there anything else people should look out for or listen to with you?
Just look out for each other, I think. Look out for friends and family. Check in on people. And me and my wife have got a podcast called Partners in Crime, a true crime podcast.
Oh, wow.
Available exclusively on Spotify.
How lovely. Have you started it?
Yeah, we've like we've got a few episodes in the can. It's been nice. It's been fun.
That's nice, isn't it?
We didn't think we were going to sort of, thought it'd be a bit stressful, but we've actually really enjoyed doing it. It's fun, isn't it? It's fun. I hadn't actually done many podcasts. I've still not done that many podcasts, really. I sort of weirdly was scared of them. But I'm doing more now, and I like it.
Ah, what a nice
I've only
boy.
Done about three or four.
Well, I'm on it. I'm very on it. Well, Ian Sterling, an absolute delight. Good luck with season two. I look forward to seeing it. And I look forward to seeing you next time I see you with another huge change. Perhaps three more children and some crawling along the ceiling. Love to you. Good day.
I, Ian Sterling.
Good day. So that was episode 232. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 20 minutes of chat, secrets and video with Ian. Don't miss the first two episodes of Shrinking, available on Apple TV Plus from the 27th of January. Go to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, but write about the film that means the most to you and why. It's a lovely thing to read, helps with numbers, blah, 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 you know all that, and it's very much appreciated. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Ian for giving me his time. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the photography. Come and join me next week for another amazing guest. You will love it. I hope you're all well. Love to you all. So that is it for now. Have a lovely week. And in the meantime, please, now more than ever, be excellent to each other. Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind. Sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Maureen, your Canva presentation looks brilliant.
Thanks, Brett. That's because I used AI-powered Canva presentations. I just described what I wanted, and Canva presentations generated the perfect slides. You can even make a talking presentation for people to watch on their own time. Check this out. Recording. 101 Reasons Why Beaches is the Saddest Film Ever Made by your neighbour Maureen. Is it easy to use? If you can use a computer, you can nail your next work presentation with Canva Presentations at canva.com, designed for work. Oh, thanks, my name is Maureen. Yeah, thank you.